We're about to begin the second session this morning. My name's Sandra Evans. I'm chairing this session. Professor Oliver Turnbull will be talking now until 12:15, and then Penny Garner will be talking until 1:45, and then we'll have 15 minutes for questions and discussion. So I don't need to say anything more now, and just leave you to Professor Turnbull.
Thank you very much. How does the sound sound? Can you hear me reasonably well at the back? Okay, fantastic. That's very good news. Firstly, thank you very, very much for the invitation. I think for two reasons. The first of them, I'm a human lesion neuropsychologist, I suppose, by primary trade, and my special interest is in emotion, many aspects of emotion. But like many people in midlife, I've been sucked into management. So I'm the pro vice chancellor of my university through a series of administrative errors. And having a chance to come and talk to people about the thing that I really care about rather than herding cats, which is my day job, is a real joy. So that's one reason why it's wonderful. The second is that I've been waiting for about a decade to give this talk. I published amongst some other papers on emotion and its neurobiological basis, some things that seemed increasingly relevant to me for dementia and its potential treatment. Even though only a small fraction of those papers, actually in this case only one of them, was actually on a patient who has a degenerative disease. Many of the others, as you'll see, are stroke patients. But I felt that the message somehow needed to get out to the community. And it may well be, and I hear from our first speaker today, who said a lot of really wonderful and very pertinent things from my talk, that some of these will be ideas which are familiar to you, but perhaps the science side hasn't been as well clarified as it could have been. I might be wrong about that, but my impression is that that's the case. So I'm going to talk a lot about neuropsychology and the neuroscience of emotion and the like, and that's my big plan. Like a lot of other people who work in labs, these are people who have been in my lab in the last couple of years, and I'd like to thank all of them for their work. It wouldn't have happened without them. I supervise more PhD students who produce the scientific work now than I'm able to exclusively on my own, and I'm very grateful to all of them for their efforts. So my big plan is to try to summarize things. Firstly, to start from a fairly blank piece of paper for those of us who don't have a background, for example, in the neuroscience of emotion, by talking about the brain systems that underpin emotion very briefly and point out that, as Freud presciently suggested, they're very ancient. They're really phylogenetically and indeed ontogenetically very old. I'll try to make it clear that one amongst the many other things which they do, these systems facilitate a system that we've come to call emotion-based learning, but may actually be the psychological phenomenon that we sometimes describe as intuition or gut feelings or hunches and so on, which are emotionally generated, so that the literature really appears to show. Then I'm going to talk more about this emotion, these emotion learning systems, and in particular to point out that they are entirely anatomically and indeed functionally independent from episodic memory systems, from those memory systems which we know decline in the traditional and most common form of degenerative disease, which is Alzheimer's. The medial temporal structures of the hippocampus and the perihippocampal gyrus go, but those are not the systems that underpin emotion-based learning, which is, I think, very interesting. This has, as I'll point out towards the end of my talk, some implications for care in dementia. Some of them were already covered by our first speaker, and you'll be aware of many of them. What I'm seeking to do is to build up the science end of that. And indeed, this literature also has some important implications for psychotherapy, and indeed the question of psychotherapy in dementia, which I have a few opinions on as well. I'm not an expert on either point three or four here, but they are the things that I've been waiting 10 years to say to an audience. So if you can wait for half an hour, I'll get right on to them. Okay, so here's the first part of the talk. My apologies if this covers material which is familiar to any of you, but I think it's good to be foundational. If I'd been giving this talk 30 years ago and I'd talked about the neurobiology of emotion, I probably would have emphasized hemispheric asymmetry and the role of the left and right hemispheres in the perception and expression of emotion. And it's true. There is a very good literature suggesting that the right cerebral hemisphere is more important for perceiving and expressing emotions. But the last couple of decades have made it abundantly clear that cortical asymmetries, right versus left hemisphere issues, are not the big picture when it comes to emotion, and certainly not if you come at things from a psychodynamic background. the cortical role for emotion is, if I can put it as succinctly as possible, is more cognitive than visceral. So, for example, the capacity to separate and identify whether you're looking at a happy or a sad or a disgusting face, which is a really complex visuospatial task, relies on the right cerebral hemisphere more than the left, unquestionably so. But does that mean that the visceral experience of happiness or sadness or disgust, that overwhelming sensation that we get when we're terrified or when we're elated, is that run by the right cerebral hemisphere? Absolutely not. There's abundant evidence, firstly, that lesion to the right cerebral hemisphere doesn't change those visceral emotions, and indeed that a range of other structures, which are much more phylogenetically ancient, are really important for the visceral gut feeling, motivational aspects of emotion. And those are run by a range of subcortical brain systems that begin in the upper brain stem, and I might return to this question a little bit later, in relation to the very important question of death, projecting forwards from an area called the periaqueductal gray. It's not important to focus overly on the anatomy. The upper brain stem, the old, in Paul McLean's terms, the reptilian brain, and project forward to a range of subcortical structures which specialize out those emotions for what we call the basic emotion systems, the ones that underpin happiness, sadness, anger, and fear, and the like. They're all joined uniformly at the top end of the brainstem, and indeed are divided into two separate parts, one of which codes for what we might reasonably call pleasure, and the other indeed for unpleasure. But they become differentiated in the more recent areas of evolutionary development, specifically as across all mammal series, you see this this common set of phylogenetically very ancient structures. There are a limited number of these basic emotion systems, and I won't talk about them now, but somewhere between 4, 6, 7 are the arguments that my field wants to fight for. The number is not important. Just to demonstrate that this work, much of this previous work, by the way, was carried out in non-human animals, in which it's always difficult to identify exactly what we mean by emotions. But the literature was turned around in the year 2000 by an important paper by Tony DiMaggio, in which he imaged emotion using the proper technique for investigating visceral experience, which is not what the literature had previously done, which was to show people happy versus sad faces. It's a skill related to emotion, but it's the visuospatial aspect of emotion, not the visceral experience. He got people who were able to imagine themselves in situations, life experiences, which made them, for example, very happy or very sad or very angry. They were able to choose people who were able to have these experiences by recollection in a scanner, which is not an easy skill, but were able, for example, in the sadness conditions, to remember things that were so traumatic to them that they were able to cry while they were lying in the scanner and then scanned them. And the correct answer for what happens here, here they are for all the range of basic emotions. I'll focus in on the sadness condition, which, because sadness is so important to human beings, seems to be the area that gets the best activation. Here's the big ticket item. At the bottom here, what you'll see is a huge activation of areas of the upper brainstem and moving forwards here through the thalamus and indeed to the anterior cingulate gyrus. So that is very phylogenetically ancient brain structures. You'll notice also that this activation is bilaterally symmetrical. There's no left versus right activity going on. And what you see while these people are crying in the scanner is either no change in the level of activation of the cortex or, in some cases, active underactivation. So these people are pulling resources away from cognitive systems, from ego systems, and instead activating very phylogenetically ancient systems. That's the essence that underpins this. Okay, so that's the first part of the argument. That is, the visceral experience, the motivational aspects of emotion, are phylogenetically very old, very, very old. But I'm interested personally not in the visceral experience, but the way they interact with cognitive processes, and in particular in this phenomenon that we've come to call emotion-based learning. And the question there is, how do these old emotion systems interact with the new clever bits of the brain? The neuropsychology that we were all raised on a few decades ago focused on the lateral convexity of the brain and the way in which perceptual systems on the outside projected forwards to prefrontal cortex. But actually there's another way of getting to the clever bits of prefrontal cortex, and that's in the medial parts of the brain, where these ancient brain systems, which I've now again coded in red over here, can project forwards to prefrontal cortex that I've coded in green and add emotion to the cleverest bits of the brain in a very direct and interesting way. And it seems that this access of emotion systems to executive functions seems to underpin our ability to make complicated decisions. Not the easy ones, the rote learning ones, but the intuitive ones in which we have to navigate complex emotional landscapes, make difficult decisions which are ambiguous, uncertain, you know, when you should make a joke at a dinner party, whether someone really is flirting with you or not. You know, who should you trust this person to look after your child for a few hours or not? Those sorts of intuitive of decisions that are absolutely essential for the everyday interpersonal lives that we try to lead are not mediated by the clever outside bits of the cerebral hemispheres, but by these ancient brain systems and the way that we learn, probably with enormous variability across individual differences, to influence executive function. Okay, the standard tool for trying to measure this, there have been a few attempts, but the sort of the industry standard measure is something called the Iowa Gambling Task, introduced by Antoine Bachara about 20 years ago now. It's a very complicated four-deck card task, so complicated that people can't follow the rules, which is the sort of the point of the whole thing, because being able explicitly... it does seem bizarre, but it's true. Being able to explicitly know which decks are good or bad is too hard to follow, and instead you need to follow your intuitive feelings or hunches or whatever the correct phrase is to describe this. I won't spend too much time describing the nature of it all, but people get to choose across 100 trials, you know, from things where they get a reward, actually an explicit financial reward and often a sound as well and a smiley face on the screen. We pay our patients hard cash because it seems to motivate people more directly, but you can get similar effects with money that's just more notional. Here's a few pictures in our lab, which I won't spend too much time showing you details on. But the bottom line, just because I'll show you one or two of these graphs a little bit later in the talk, is that people, you know, neurologically and psychiatrically normal individuals on this task start out below chance when they don't know which the good or the bad decks are. For what it's worth, by the way, the good decks, I should tell you about the bad decks first. The bad decks are things which provide substantial rewards but are also very risky. If you're a sensation-seeking, high-risk individual, they're really a lot of fun. And early on, we can all see the advantages of that, so we gravitate towards those decks. The good decks, on the other hand, are dull. They are like paying your pension plan or your mortgage. It's not exciting, but if you keep plugging away at it, in the long run, your life will definitely be better. And that's what neurologically and psychiatrically intact individuals do. They start out by going for the risky, fun things, and in the end, they realize that you'd be better off in the long run if you plod away on other activities. So here's a series of papers that we published a decade or so ago now on the topic. You can collect skin conductance data and so on to gather more about the emotional lives of these individuals. But the important issue is what happens when you lesion different brain areas and people are asked to perform this task. Here's some data on patients with lesions here in ventromesial frontal cortex, so that area where the old brain systems that underpin visceral emotion project forwards to prefrontal cortex. These patients who have what Tony DiMaggio calls myopia for the future, they're driven by immediate positive decisions rather than the long-term consequences, which, of course, is what pension plans and mortgages are all about. You know, they seem to have difficulty choosing the good decks. They're not very exciting sorts of decks. And here's the performance of patients of the sort on this task. Here are some controls who start below chance and get much better and then plateau over 100 trials. These patients just stay bad. They keep gambling on things that seem like a good idea at the time, but ultimately don't take them anywhere. And you'll know this performance because arguably one of the most, probably the most famous patient in all of human lesion neuropsychology, who's described 150 years ago now, Phineas Gage, had a lesion of just exactly those brain areas. Does everyone in the room know about Phineas Gage? So he had a terrible railway accident. He was a very efficient and effective supervisor on a railway in the northeast of the United States. And then he had an incident in which he looked into a tamping rod, which is this big beast over here, and then just checking to see whether it had gone in properly, it exploded and passed up through his cheekbone and then through the medial parts of his frontal lobe, But he survived, remarkably, considering that this was 150 years ago and it was an entirely open wound. There were bits of brain everywhere, so the original description lies. But he survived for several years. His performance is remarkable, firstly because of the apparent intellectual preservation of a patient like this. They're still smart. Certainly in the modern patients that are described of the sort who tend to have motor vehicle accidents rather than tamping iron accidents. They do very well on IQ tests. They have lots of intelligence, but they seem to have a difficulty using it in practical ways. Their decision-making is very poor, and they're usually described as having personality change of one description or another. The road traffic accident literature is full of patients of the sort. The original description by Harlow in the 1840s says that his friends said that he was no longer Gage. He'd become a different person, even though he still seemed very sensible in lots of ways, and he lost his job because he was impulsive and made very rapid and inappropriate decisions. He then, in the end, actually traveled on a sort of traveling circus exhibition with, I'm horrified to say, his tamping iron in tow as a sort of Victorian exhibit of the sort that happened in those days. You can still see the original iron, in the Smithsonian in the US. So this brain area that seems to be very important for navigating uncertain and unpredictable interpersonal worlds, intuition-based phenomena, is mediated by these medial frontal brain structures. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk. My second point is that these emotion-based learning brain systems are independent of the systems which we normally consider to be the thing that we have as memory, which is typically described in my world as episodic memory. That is the conscious recollection of specific events that happen in your past. And why would we think that they would be independent? And indeed, can they be independent in dementia? Well, the simple way forward in all of this is to look at the anatomy of these two systems. I've just told you about the anatomy of emotion-based learning systems, which run from these ancient structures forward to prefrontal cortex. What about the anatomy of episodic memory? Well, we've known that for more than 50 years as well, since the work really of Scoville and Milner, who described the second most famous patient in all of human neuropsychology, the patient HM, who died a couple of years ago. He had temporal lobe epilepsy, and as a result, had both hippocampi surgically removed. We now know that the correct answer is only to remove the diseased hippocampus, not both of them, but Scoville made that unfortunate discovery as part of the series in the 1950s. It completely cured his epilepsy, but made him profoundly amnesic. And we've known since then that we need the medial temporal lobe structures, the hippocampi, and indeed the areas that are around them, the parahippocampal gyrus primarily, on the medial part of the temporal lobe, in order to sustain memory. And indeed, we need the projections forward, through areas called the fornix towards the mammillary bodies and some structures in the thalamus that are not very important for our point now, because I'm especially interested in the role of the medial temporal lobe on these for these patients. So that surgical resection of this area produces profound episodic memory impairment. So HM remembers nothing from the period since he had his memory, even though he has a reasonable recollection of his earlier childhood events. And as you all know, in at least the most common form of dementing illness, that is Alzheimer's disease, the prototypical presentation is that patients have atrophy of these medial temporal lobe structures, which produce that classic loss of recent memory ability with a preservation of immediate memory and a preservation of those old ancient memories, those retrograde memories that arrive from the early part of life. So he looks surgically like a patient in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. Now, I would like to point out that my world, the human lesion neuropsychology world, discovered quite early on, that is in the 1960s and 1970s, that episodic memory, this conscious recollection of specific personal events, is only one of half a dozen or so different memory systems, all of which are running in parallel. The emotion-based one that I've talked to you most recently about is a new arrival on the scene. The initial discoveries weren't in the affective domain, but instead were in other domains. The initial discovery famously was in procedural memory. So patients like HM, when having to engage in complicated motor tasks, the famous one is mirror drawing, in which you have to trace a line in a mirror. It's really difficult for people to do. And here's the performance in these sets of graphs over here. People are bad at it when they start the task. the more times they do the task, the better and better they get. At the end of the first day, after 10 trials, they're almost flawless. On the second day, they're a little bit worse, but they get close to perfect. And by day three, they're flawless. You would think that this was the performance of you or I on this task. Instead, this is the performance of HM. He's profoundly amnesic. He can't remember anything that happened 2 minutes ago, much less 2 hours ago. He doesn't remember being tested earlier that day or the previous day. He has no episodic recall of things in the world, but he has entirely normal procedural learning abilities because those are not underpinned by the medial temporal lobe structures that we know are central for episodic memory. So what we have are a set of anatomical structures running from upper brainstem towards the medial part of the frontal lobes that I've told you earlier seem to underpin our ability to have emotion-based learning, to learn things which have emotional consequences, which is entirely separate anatomically from the structures of the medial temporal lobe and the like, which underpin our episodic recall of specific personal events. Entirely anatomically separate. And it suggests, although very little work was done in this area, at least in my world, it suggests that they should be doubly dissociable, that you can lose the one without the other. There is a long literature on the topic, but a very sporadic one. And the classic case, which you may have heard of, it was described by Edouard Claparède a century or so ago now in a famous but completely unethical experiment that he carried out on an amnesic patient with a pin. Does everyone know the Claparède story? Hands up if you haven't heard it. Okay, oh, that's a lot of people. Okay. So Claparède was responsible for a patient who was profoundly amnesic, a woman. And he noted, of course, that every day she wouldn't remember who he was. And so doing something would never get past an ethics approval committee these days. On one day, he concealed a pin in his hand and shook her hand so that, of course, she impaled herself on the pin, which was a very painful and toxic experience for her, I don't doubt. Thank you very much, and went back and saw the rest of the ward round. And then the question is, what happens the following day when the patient is exposed to the evil Dr. Claparède for a second time? And he puts out his hand to shake her hand, which she's done on many previous occasions, and she won't do anything. She won't put her hand out to shake it. Claparède asks, why? Why won't you shake my hand? And I think she says something like, surely a lady has the right not to shake a gentleman's hand. She knows there's something wrong about him. She doesn't know why. He's unpleasant, but he just feels bad for one reason or another. But she has absolutely no episodic recall of this experience. After the Claparède finding, almost nothing is done for the best part of the last century. Tony DiMaggio published a case with Edward Trunnell in the early 1990s with a famous patient called Boswell, in which they set up two stooges to do a similar sort of thing to the Claparède case, but this time with ethics approval. They had the patient in the ward for a week, and one stooge was universally charming and helpful towards the patient. Every request was supported, every offer of friendliness was made, and so on for a week. And one stooge was universally unpleasant and horrible. Every request refused, every attempted eye contact avoided. At the end of the week, can Boswell remember the patients, the stooges? Of course he can't. When asked in multiple choice questions, which of the two people do you trust more? Which would you like to spend more time with? He's very clear, of course, about which of the patients stooges he likes and doesn't like, because he has entirely intact emotion-based learning in spite of the profound loss of episodic recall. The problem with the Boswell, and they're both, I have no objection to the principles, and I'm delighted that they did the work. The problem is the simplicity of the emotional learning required in both of the cases that I've described to you so far. They involve only learning whether a single object is good or bad when that object is either always good or always bad. And the thing which we a decade ago wanted to try to address was whether these patients are capable of more complex forms of emotion-based learning, things which are ambiguous and uncertain, and in which things are sometimes good and sometimes bad, and you have to work out their probabilities. In the same way that, your friends, you will have friends, you won't have a friend who's been universally good to you or universally bad to you. People have, shades of, shades of gray. They have shades of light and dark about them. Your best friend will across the course of your life have done something that upsets you, but you're able to balance the probabilities and work out how to, and indeed your worst enemy will have tried to be nice to you on some occasions, but you won't be fooled by the occasional attempt at a charm. So the question is, can these patients manage more complicated forms of emotion-based learning? So that was the first case that we described nearly a decade ago now. This is a patient in his 80s. As I said, most of our work is with stroke patients rather than with Alzheimer's disease, who has a left posterior cerebral artery infarction, in fact, probably a bilateral one, but it's clearer to see on scan on the left-hand side. And I'll just give you a rough feel for his overall performance, because you want to believe, you want to know that this patient is profoundly amnesic. So here's his performance on a range of episodic memory measures on the Wechsler Intelligence Scale, where he scores, you know, at floor on every single task. We meet him every day. He doesn't, of course, remember who we are. I don't know what your experience is with patients who are amnesic in dementia, but in my experience, they all tend to think that Margaret Thatcher is still the Prime Minister. No matter when you test them, she seems to have an impression on the minds of the British public that other Prime Ministers, I think we've had five since then, don't seem to have achieved. But like many of these patients, he has intact performance on immediate memory tasks, like mental control and indeed digit span. So he's profoundly amnesic, can't remember us from one day to the next, but we'd want to see how he does on an emotion-based learning task. I'd like to say, by the way, also, that our experience of the patient, which has been echoed by some of the things that people have said earlier today, was of a change of our relationship with him across the testing sessions, because he tested him for several weeks. Initially, he's skeptical. Who are you? Why are you here? You know, who sent you? And how do you do this task every 60 seconds or so, because he's profoundly amnesic. But as time goes by, he still asks us how to do the task because he doesn't remember it. But he stops being judgmental about us and asking us who we are and under what circumstances are we permitted to be here to visit him. So he gets warmer. And indeed, we described an earlier patient that Mark Solms and Karen Kaplan-Solms described, who was amnesic, who showed a similar sort of change in what arguably might be described as a transference relationship across time. Here's this patient's performance on the Iowa gambling task. He has controls who are very good, and he has a patient who's a little bit worse. But the remarkable thing is, in spite of a profound amnesia, he can remember nothing from 2 minutes ago. He's doing, he's at levels more or less comparable with controls. Here's his performance across 3 weeks compared with controls who are in blue, and he's not significantly different, indeed marginally by chance, outperforms them the third time that he does this. So he has complete preservation, as far as we can tell, of emotion-based learning, in spite of his profound amnesia. Is this true in dementia? Well, a couple of years ago, we sought to see whether we could demonstrate a similar effect in a patient who had Alzheimer's disease with Catherine Evans, who was the same. She's now Evans Roberts, but she was the same Evans that was in one of the earlier papers. And partly, I think, driven by the sort of person-centered approach that has been growing in importance in the care of people who have dementia, but it seemed to me lacked some of the empirical foundational support that it could have had. Here's a description from our original paper that those working with people with dementia claim that despite their episodic memory impairments, the feelings, emotions, and interpersonal responses of someone with dementia appear to remain intact. It has been argued that people with dementia still remember love, they are still able to express and experience love and to form new and lasting relationships. And they describe a client who, despite demonstrating profound recent episodic memory problems, still interacted with people at a daycare center warmly, greeted the authors with smiles, and expressed pleasure at seeing them. Interestingly, not all of the interpersonal interactions were positive. For example, she also displayed a consistent irritation with a particular volunteer at the service. So it's not that they've suddenly become more charming, more lovely and friendly. They are still able to differentiate good versus bad people based on the emotional consequences of their interactions. Again, I won't belabor the point by spending too much time on the neuropsychological findings, but this is the patient who's scoring, at floor or at chance on conventional measures of episodic memory recall, profoundly amnesic, but is much better in performance of things that rely more on immediate memory. So at the sort of mild to moderate end of the dementia scale, probably more moderate than anything else. And here, is a description by the patient's wife about his interaction. We particularly wanted to know whether he was able to acquire new, changed relationships with people that he'd met since his dementia began. Mrs. A described that her husband's feelings towards these recent friends and acquaintances remained consistent. For example, Mrs. A commented that her husband had formed a close friendship with three people who also had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. Although he could not recognize these friends or recall previous conversations, once reintroduced, they consistently got on well. Interestingly, their relationship appeared to develop over time, and they now often discuss the emotional impact of their diagnoses and provided support for each other. Interestingly, not all of Mr. A's recent interpersonal interactions were positive. Mr. A displayed a consistent dislike for a particular doctor after a difficult appointment, despite not being able to recall the specific event. So more or less the same sort of phenomenon. These patients have, by and large, intact, he appears on this argument, to have intact emotion-based learning despite his profound episodic memory impairment. Here's his performance on the Iowa gambling task compared with some age and education match controls, getting better at more or less the same sort of rate. Remarkable, considering that he can't remember what happened 2 minutes ago. Here's his performance across 3 weeks compared with controls. If any of you are sort of pedantically obsessed with experimental design, we reversed the contingency relationship in the middle week so that you can't argue things about procedural memory, but I probably won't get those sorts of criticisms here. I do sometimes at more experimental psychology audiences. They say it's procedural learning. It's not, because it doesn't matter whether you reverse which decks are good versus bad. It's about learning new things about each emotional experience. Okay, so that's the core of the data that I want to suggest to you. I'll add a few things later. And now I want to pass on to those things that I promised I would say that I'd been waiting a long time to be able to say. So the first of them are implications for care in dementia. And I really don't know very much about this literature. People in this room probably know much more than me, but I'll give you my 5 pence worth for what it's worth. The person-centered approach seems to me to have a very strong moral case, but it doesn't have as strong an empirical case as it should have. And I think the findings that we are presenting, and indeed lots of other people have followed on the work that we've done and investigated more patients who've had stroke and as a result are amnesic, not all of them seem to show preserved emotion-based learning, but many of them do. So there's a good evidence base for that. And we live in a very evidence-based medicine world, so the more support you can have that comes from, you know, peer-reviewed scientific journals, I would have thought the better that we can the better we can manage. In addition, I'm concerned, as indeed the first speaker alluded to, about the behavior of at least some carers towards patients. We're full of a room here of people who I don't doubt are charming and empathetic, but every now and again when I watch the television and I see some reports about carers on the news, it becomes clear to me that not everyone who cares for people with dementia seems to be treating with the respect that they deserve. And it had occurred to me, although I know no empirical evidence on the topic, that it might be based on a misunderstanding, at least in part, about the nature of memory loss. It seems to me that at least some of their prejudice against people who have dementia is based on the assumption that they can't remember things. And it doesn't matter how you treat somebody if they're going to forget everything that happened to them 2 minutes ago. And that may well be true if there was only one class of memory system, but indeed they've lost only the episodic memory component of that broad range of ability to learn about the world, because those are the brain areas that go first in dementia. A number of other memory systems, especially those related to emotion-based learning, are, at least in some patients, entirely intact. So they're going to remember everything that happened to them across the last little while, and I suspect that there are a fair few people out there who have very bad experiences with carers who react badly to those individuals because they've been treated badly by them, but of course are in no position to defend themselves because they can't say, I remember that, you know, this particular carer wasn't a very nice individual. So I suspect that if nothing else, there's a sort of psychoeducation role that might potentially be available for these sorts of results, especially because of their peer-reviewed empirical basis to be rolled out. And I'm looking for somebody out there, which is what I've been waiting 10 years for, to do the study that will investigate, you know, what people who care for those who have dementia believe about the memories of their of the patients in their care, and indeed whether a small psychoeducation intervention, which informed them about the ways in which some memory systems go but others are preserved, might make a difference to their care. It's possible that a relatively modest psychoeducation intervention might make a difference there. I just offer it to anybody. I can't do it. I have no time. I'm too busy managing cats in my day job. But if somebody else wants to do it, I would be over the moon. Okay. The other thing which seems very clear to me is the question of implications for psychotherapy. And again, I don't think so much about psychotherapy and dementia because I come from the stroke world, but I do care about the understanding of doing psychotherapy with people who have memory impairments. As it turns out, my world, the world of neuropsychological rehabilitation, for example, 5 minutes, I'll be on time, the world of neuropsychological rehabilitation is remarkably biased against doing psychotherapy with anyone who has a memory impairment. Their argument is, well, and 75% of therapists, these are people who work with head injury patients more than anything else, or stroke patients, that impaired memory is the most significant challenge to forming a working alliance, is the literature here. I think, again, it may be based on a belief about the capacity of the patient to work effectively rather than any decent evidence, because I've just showed you some, I think, very interesting evidence. It also might be based upon an understanding of the ways in which different forms of psychotherapy are presumed to work. I particularly, for example, know that the essence, for example, at least in principle, of what cognitive behavioral therapists think they do, even though many of them are doing more than they think they do, but that's another matter. In principle, CBT is about telling the patient, working with the patient, to see what they should be practicing during the week, and then the patient needs to do their homework during the week. That requires, of course, that you episodically recall what happened in the previous session and then implement it during the week. But, of course, if you have no episodic recall, then that's likely to be a challenge to things. The entire argument underpinning the psychodynamic approach at the opposite end of the spectrum is indeed that it's about the relationship that you have with a therapist and that it has nothing to do with learning to do your homework. So what I've been seeking to do, and as part of another strand of my research, is to effectively investigate which cognitive abilities do you need and which don't you need in order to do reasonable work in psychotherapy. And I suspect that emotion-based learning systems are very important for underpinning, for example, the therapeutic alliance, which we all know is the number one predictor of outcome in psychotherapy and may have nothing to do with emotion-based, with episodic memory systems, which can be quite profoundly lost. We haven't published this paper yet. My apologies for sending you for talking about an under-review paper, but I've got a psychoanalytic colleague of mine who's been working for 12 months with a patient who's profoundly amnesic after an anoxic episode. He's a diabetic and things went very badly wrong. He's still quite young, and Paul reports in that case. I'm just his supervisor. A number of experiences that followed from that, including, by the way, the very interesting countertransference that Paul himself as a therapist becomes more amnesic and forgetful when working with this patient than he does with his non-amnesic patients, which I think is very interesting. And also the use of the analyst as a form of joint memory. So the patient, of course, can't remember what happened in the last session, but together they can have a greater likelihood of reconstructing the events that had happened in the previous hour, and the patient appears to be able to use the analyst as an external aid, which I think is a very helpful and interesting point. We also have some data on the anxiety and depression scores for this patient, who, of course, remembers nothing that had happened in any of the previous sessions, but who is, at least according to self-report, and given his profound episodic memory impairment, he doesn't have a great capacity for being able to fake this, seems to be getting better both in terms of anxiety and depression. Okay. So, as far as I know, and there are lots of people doing work in a psychotherapeutic suit, psychotherapeutic sort with Alzheimer's disease, I don't see any big studies out there demonstrating efficacy. And frankly, I think that that's what needs to be done. That we live in a world of health economics, and if we can demonstrate the health economic advantages, which seem to me, by the way, very clear, given that patients with dementia who are in care are very expensive, and patients who are living in the community are much less expensive, and psychotherapy is not that expensive, if you can make a case for how much money it might save, maybe it might get some of the bean counters to think twice about how they allocate resources towards services. And that's entirely in addition to the moral case, but it seems to me that some of the funders don't flow for the moral case very easily, and the health economics case might be a little bit easier. So my last slide, you'd be pleased to hear, for our timekeeper. I think the data hopefully offer some empirical support for this, for the arguments which the person-centered approach has been putting forward. It may be, as you may say in the questions later, that people have done this work already and there's lots of empirical support, but I'm only offering our small quadrant of the world to see whether it helps. I think there's potentially a role for psychoeducation in all of this, which seems to me untapped, but maybe there is someone out there doing it. There's certainly a role for psychotherapy, which it seems needs a much larger trial. And if so, I think we can start to enlarge the part of the landscape which is available for psychotherapy by compared with pharmacotherapy, which it seems has a larger foothold in the treatment of those with dementia than it perhaps deserves. So on that front, and hopefully on time, I would like to finish. Thank you so much for listening.